Just for the benefit of those who don't know you so well, who is Thomas West?
38-year-old, tired dad, just kind of struggling to survive. From North Carolina and Alabama in the States. Lord saved me as a boy in a kid's work at First Baptist Church in Montgomery, Alabama. Studied for master's and PhD in theology in North Carolina, was a pastor there for 7 years, and moved here 4 years ago. Very grateful for commission, supplied a visa, kept me around, and kept me taught and encouraged, which I'm very grateful for. And we planted Redeemer Queens Park, new church, Northwest London. We celebrate our 2-year anniversary, not this weekend, but the following.
Either best bit of advice you got 3-4 years ago, or thing you wish you had been told 3 or 4 years ago?
The emphasis on the timing and the slow place, like the slow pace, getting your expectations right, was really helpful. We came in rip-roaring ready to go, but just almost embracing that year one as we got to get in here and break the soil, and we have to learn the specific microculture within London. That was indeed crucial. That was incredibly helpful.
And what's encouraging you at Redeemer at the moment?
I mean, that so much of the church doesn't run through me now. There's plenty of things that I have to still be involved with and speak into. But, we committed ourselves in those early days to developing leaders, developing elders, caring for people well. In God's great grace, I mean, it looks like a local church, smells like a local church, dysfunctions like a local church. So it's legit, and that's incredibly encouraging, like God's grace. So, just really grateful for the season. It's really taken shape. And, similar to some of Paul's that I can see, fighting for life in lots of ways, but real and planted. So it's encouraging. I am really, really, really grateful for the opportunity to be with you today. A lot of what's happening in Queens Park today was shaped by what I was taught around these tables for our first 2 years in London. So incredibly grateful for the structure of this program and getting to learn all kinds of ideas. I'll make two statements for you at the outset of this. One, I do not intend to bore you to tears. We're going to have some times where you're going to pause, you're going to chat with your neighbor, and you're going to hopefully be able to reflect personally on your own formation and on some of the content that's presented here. And two is just a note on that content. I make zero claims to originality today. All the good stuff I have, I stole from somebody else. And I come to you as an organizer and compiler of information, but not as a unique genius in my own right. So I think that ought to put you at ease and maybe even help you perk up a little bit, because you're not listening to me. I'm just literally copying and pasting some stuff from some other guys. So I've been asked to share with you for just a few minutes on this idea of missionary encounter. And you should have a resource. There's somewhere between a resource and an outline. You can figure out what it is by the end of this. Just four headings we'll work through. Number one, who was Leslie Newbegin? Number two, what is a theology of missionary encounter? Number three, what would be involved in having a missionary encounter today? And fourthly, quickly, relevant reading and resources. Yeah? So we're going to be talking about missionary encounter. I'm going to show you how this one person named Leslie was formed throughout his life, through the different experiences that he went through. It kind of gave him an awareness of what a missionary encounter even is. And we'll have a look at what Newbegin meant by that. Just briefly, we'll consider what the top Newbegin scholar Michael Goheen says about that. And maybe most helpful for us today, we'll consider in conclusion what Tim Keller says about the whole thing, because I think Tim Keller is that moment of synthesis that we really, really need for this subject right now, where Keller read through Newbegin heavily, but integrated it into a bit of a modern ministry context in New York, and he was able to expand upon some of his ideas. So that's where we're going just briefly. Promise I'll stick to time and we'll get to lunch. So very grateful to be able to chat with you. So first things, I want you to turn to a neighbor, and I want you to discuss These two questions right here. Have you ever returned to a familiar place only to find it different from when you left? And what allowed you to see that difference? Describe what that felt like. So audience participation time. Turn to somebody, start chatting right there. Go ahead. About 2 minutes. So why don't we start with this question? We start with this question because the sensation of returning somewhere and realizing things are radically off from when you left was the sensation that Leslie Newbegin had in 1974 when he arrived in the UK. Let me give you some shape to his life, okay? Newbegin was born on the 8th of December, 1909 in Northumbria, and he died on the 30th of January just over here in Herne Hill, 1998. So in these 88 years that Newbegin had his go for the Lord, there was an ever-growing appreciation for what the gospel is and an ever-growing sensitivity to the different cultural context that he found himself in. Son of a Presbyterian businessman who worked in the shipping minister. He had a Scottish mother. His father enrolled him in a boarding school, Quaker boarding school in Leeton Park in Reading. And he sat under the teaching, was formed in a lot of ways, left that season of his life, those early childhood years, though, in boarding school, with a very clear recognition. I wasn't a Christian. The possibility, the hypothesis of God wasn't completely untenable for him, but he made it through. He wasn't a Christian, though he had some ideas around him. Those university and those seminary years, 1928 to 1939, he checks in at Queen's in Cambridge. Studies there, gets involved in the student missionary movement. He's off working with some coal miners as a university student. And he's lying there one night, and he was converted through a vision. He was lying there. He was actually coming up against the hardness of lostness the whole time. What's interesting about his story is he recounts it. He was involved in the student Christian movement, but apparently he wasn't a Christian, right? So trying to have a go against lostness. And he's lying there one night and he has this vision of the cross embracing the whole world. Now, some would say this is where kind of a strand of universalism might be incepted into his thought. But in his own words, he says, I just knew from that moment on, if I was going to make sense of how lost people thought, I had to begin where they are. I had to think like that and always had to read it through the cross. It's really, really fascinating stuff. He makes it back. He trains at Westminster, still at Cambridge, and he's commissioned to go overseas as a foreign missionary to India, actually commissioned out of the Church of Scotland, and he shows up in India, 1936. And when he gets there, he has this really wild moment. All the people around him, the Methodists, the Church of England people, the Baptists, the Anglican, I mean, everybody around, everybody had their own strategy. Everybody had their own shtick, what we're going to do and how we're going to do it. But no one was working together. And something that's going to show up real late in his thought in his writings is this real burden for unity. He shows up in India, working in Kashapuram, and there's this overwhelming lostness all around. And there's all of these trained, well-intending people, and no one wants to partner. That leads him to do something pretty radical, to leave his missionary appointment. He actually founds a new denomination called the Church of South India. They end up making this guy bishop of the thing in Madurai. And this is his life. Church planting, evangelism, working amongst people, just finding people that had a really simple, like core theology, like Jesus, sin, and salvation stuff, and just partnering and working it, just having a go in India. This is his life. There's some time in here where he gets involved in the ecumenical movement. At one point, he 59 to 65, he's serving as bishop in Madras. And then he's going to get involved as the recording secretary for the World Council of Churches. Now, some of us know about this, some of us don't. You almost can't look back and read it for the wake of it theologically. You almost have to like see it from where Newbegin could see it. Coming up in this time when he's really trying to get Jesus to lost people, and people have these long like codes of affiliation, and there wasn't much unity. So Newbegin's trying to find a way to get in there and to navigate this. So he gets involved. He's like, man, how can we get around? How can we get resources around? How can we get Jesus around? And how do we bring Jesus to people? This is his big thing. And what's happening throughout his life, his understanding of the mission of God and his understanding of the role of the church within the mission of God is being formed and shaped in all these different ways. Loads that could be said here. But that feeling you just encountered, you got a fresh contact with when you went somewhere and you came back and it's just very different. Here comes New Begin's approach. 1974, he's retiring from 40 years as a foreign worker, as a cross-cultural missionary, evangelist, and church planter, and he's beginning his journey home. Now, I want you to imagine the path that he and his wife Helen took coming up out of India. They traveled north through Delhi, they traveled into Pakistan, across Afghanistan and Iran, made their way through Turkey. They spent some time in Cappadocia, and there he had that feeling. This place used to be the very cradle of Christianity, and he couldn't find a Christian to worship with on Sunday. It gave him that impression, man, places that were once the stronghold of something, man, if they go uncared for, man, it can be lost. So they continued their journey home. New Begin reflected on his experience. Cappadocia, once the nursery of Christian theology, was the only place in the whole trip where we couldn't find a Christian in the whole thing. New Begin realized how thoroughly a strong Christian heritage can just disappear. D.A. Carson says this more relevantly for us. One generation has the gospel, the next generation assumes the gospel, the next generation loses the gospel. That's what New Begin experiences. He was making his way through the old world. Lands in London, 1974. He loved Edinburgh. They got up to Edinburgh. That's where he's always trying to get away. They took some time there to settle in. He did some reading. His light reading in that time, he read all 12 or 13 volumes of Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics, just as a little bit of refresher to kind of get himself back into it. And then he's sitting around thinking, what's going on here? Because the England that he left in 1974, the UK that he left in 1936 was radically different than the one he found in 1974. And he had that feeling that you know something about. You show up and it's like, what's happened here? What he realized is that the church in Western culture wasn't living with missionary urgency and zeal like the church in other parts of the world. Specifically, that very unreached place of India where he was ministering at the time. So he had a choice, you know. He could get on Twitter and he could just start burning people down and being grumpy and complaining. Or he could get involved. And he chose to get involved. Instead of grumpily sitting on the sidelines as a 70-year-old man running into his 80s, he made his way up to Birmingham. He became a lecturer in theology and mission at Selly Oak Colleges, which has now been acquired by the University of Birmingham. His whole archive is located there. You can go find it. Interestingly enough, that's where all of Winston Churchill's stuff is located as well. And you can go rummage through the archives. And you can see handwritten notes, typewriter all the time. And you can like follow this guy's footsteps. As you follow his footsteps, you'll come to see something was really, really key for this guy. He became focused in his latter years of life at asking and answering one central question. What would be involved in a genuinely missionary encounter between the gospel and modern Western culture? 1974, he's sitting next to someone named General Samaratpong. He was an Indonesian general who got involved in the ecumenical movement. They're sitting off somewhere in Indonesia in 74. And Samaratpong, they're talking about what needs to happen in the world. We've got to evangelize these people, evangelize those people. Samaratpong turns to New Begin and just whispers to him in the middle of this meeting, the real question in all of this is, can Western culture be converted? Here's New Begin's response. It's at the bottom of page 1. New Begin says, I knew, of course, that he was right. Among all the cultures which have power in the contemporary world, the culture which originated in Western Europe is the most powerful and pervasive of all cultures. It dominates the cities of the world. What is called modernization in Asia and Africa is usually co-opted into this way of thinking and behaving. And it is precisely this powerful culture which is most resistant to the gospel. Christianity is a growing movement in large parts of the third world, his language here, rapidly growing in some places. In the West, it is on the defensive, if not actually shrinking. Here it is. Plainly, if one is looking at the global situation of the Christian world mission, the crucial question is, can the West be converted? He's invited to give the Stone Lectures at Princeton Seminary in 84. These are the same ones that Abraham Kuyper gave that became Lectures on Calvinism. Newbegin goes there, gives a series of lectures. It becomes the very popular book, Foolishness to the Greeks. And in there, he's driving after this central question, what would be involved in a genuinely missionary encounter between the gospel and modern Western culture? Now, I think that's something we can all really get around. Because we're all sitting in London today. You're sitting in the capital of the world. You're sitting in definitely the capital of Western culture today. Newbegin, in his late writings, this body of work from 74 to 84, he writes 150 different articles. He produced over 20 books. His books are really helpful. There's these little slender books. He's not doing a whole lot with footnoting. He's writing as an occasional theologian, responding to the needs of the day. In that sense, he feels a bit like Luther. He's not trying to footnote and totally systematize a whole cathedral of thought. He's a firefighter. He sees a thing and he responds to the thing. And what he's doing in these last 10 years of his life is he's helping the church think, how are we going to deal here? What would be involved in having a genuinely missionary encounter between the gospel and Western culture? I think it's something massively important. We feel this. It's the very thing that we're all trying to get on top of in our individual lives, our families, and our ministries. Newbegin's on it. And Newbegin helps us see something really, really important about it. Western culture, unique to other cultures, Western cultures, particularly Western secularism or Western paganism, is distinct because it's born out of a rejection of Christianity. It's the issue of you can't simply say that we're divorced. You actually think about a young maiden. Like, the culture isn't that now. The young maiden was taken up in a dating relationship, in a courtship, got engaged, got married, had relationship. But now when you're divorced, you don't go back to being a young maiden. You've kind of run a cycle and you're the product of something new. And he's saying that's how we ought to think about Western culture. It had the gospel, it was Christianized thoroughly, and then assumed the gospel and has lost the gospel. But it didn't go back to where it came from. No, its hardness of belief is actually born out of a rejection of the Christianity it once possessed. And that's interesting. So that's Newbegin. That's his life. And here's why I do all of this. If we just enter in and we just start chatting, missionary encounter, if we try to get super practical, we'll actually miss the place that this is coming from. And we might not be mindful of the ways that the Lord Jesus himself has actually been forming each of us and preparing us for a missionary encounter as well. So with that in mind, I just want you to have a moment right here to turn to your neighbor again, and I want you to look back. You see some of this in Newbegin. Newbegin had these different experiences, helped him think about the mission of God and the mission of the church. What are some formative moments in your own story that have shaped your own understanding of the mission of the church? Turn to someone. Explain briefly. So your time in the ecumenical movement, and I'm kidding. Whatever your thing is, turn to somebody and just say, like, my understanding of the mission of God and the mission of the church has been formed and shaped somewhere. Try to name a few of those. It's the preaching of the pastor, books you've read, cross-cultural encounters you've had. Let's name those. Just 2 minutes here and we'll keep going. Go ahead, discuss. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, the big idea is that no one gets to come from nowhere, similar to what you were in a different way this morning. We're all coming from a particular tradition. Just a sidebar here. Whenever I'm teaching theology, you have Wesleyan's Quadrilateral, these big sources of where we get our information, scripture, tradition, reason, and experience. The way I even go about teaching theology and how I even arrange it in theological method is we actually have to start with tradition, or we have to start with history. Because it's just, we just have blind spots when we pick up the text and assume we're reading as a blank slate. That's just not true. No one gets that luxury. So we all come from a tradition. We all come from a history. We all come from a specific place. My reading of the text is informed by Baptist ecclesiology, is formed by discipleship and preaching, primarily in the American South. Only in my university seminary years did my horizon get broader than that. But I have to almost recount the tradition, recount the history that I'm carrying when I take up the text or when I want to engage with another culture. I don't show up as just a nobody. I show up as a specific somebody. And that's why we're even thinking about this. Newbegin was clearly formed and he was clearly shaped. Each of us have been clearly formed and we have been clearly shaped. So Newbegin, from his formation, he was able to ask a question. What would it take to have a missionary encounter between the gospel and modern Western culture? And that's what the rest of this time that we have together is all about. This second idea that we're in, what is a theology of missionary encounter? Or what would it mean to have a genuinely missionary encounter? Let's look at Newbegin. We'll briefly consider Goheen, Michael Goheen, and then I think most importantly, we'll actually consider Keller, and we'll see what happens, if all of this can make sense in the last 5 or 10 minutes of our time together. Newbegin's theology of missionary encounter, there's really four themes in his writing, and they're right there at the bottom of page 2. Gospel recovery, not gospel, but gospel recovery, story indwelling, theological challenge, and faithful witness. His approach to having a missionary encounter with the culture was far more than a set of ideas. It's more of a way or a pattern that the local congregation can or should live faithfully in a cultural context, right? So I'm just telling you up front, this isn't one of those things where it's like you're going to have like a 1-2-3-step play to now go have a missionary encounter with your particular substrata of London. That's not what this is. This is a bit of a theological vision. This is a particular way of appreciating the balance of gospel, cultural, and community, and trying to hold these things in tension and find a way of navigating. So what we're actually getting here, this isn't like a plan to get some people, form a diaconate or committee and hand this to them and see them go do it. We as ministers of the gospel, we're actually receiving some lenses or some spectacles that we can put on and we can look at the task of mission. That's what's on offer here. Newbegin's writings have those four things. So let's just jog through them briefly. Just appreciate them. We're not trying to get everything Newbegin has to offer. First, gospel recovery. Newbegin believed the gospel was essentially the news about what God had done in the world in Jesus Christ. And he said that news must be embodied by a whole community of people. When Newbegin read Western Culture in 1974, as a Brit who spent 40 years away from here and now had returned, Newbegin saw a church where the cultural story and the scriptural story were becoming so blended together that you actually couldn't tell what was what. Newbegin shows up and he says, what we actually need, we need to tease these stories out a little bit so we can be able to appreciate what's just our culture and what's the Christian story, because they were so blended together, you couldn't tell the difference between the two. This is what he meant by the cultural captivity of the gospel. His concern, and from 74 to the end of his life, he has this growing concern for the dominance of the Western secular worldview. And his concern isn't that Scripture is really norming it, but the secular worldview was really overriding the scriptural story in the hearts of people. So he's coming for this from a place where he's like, the Western cultural story, it's actually born out of a rejection of Christianity and is starting to overtake the cultural story, the scriptural story itself. So Newbegin's like, we gotta tease these out. And in our teaching, our preaching, our discipleship with people, we actually have to help people see it's not this, it's this. It's a practical step there. He talks about the recovery of the gospel. His awareness of his own cultural context is part of what gave him unique insights, where he said, we need to recover the gospel. If we had an all day to go here, I'd ask you to just pause right now and consider, what are the particular ways in your church community or your communities that you live amongst that the gospel has gotten co-opted into those cultural stories. For Newbegin, he saw that the particular culture that he was walking into, there was this big thing at the time called the fact-value dichotomy. This was the big thing in the 70s and 80s. Alistair MacIntyre and some other philosophers are going to work on this as well. The big idea is there's the public world of facts. That's what we talk about over here in government. This is how we're going to make decisions and run the world. There's the public world of facts. But then there's these inner world of values. And religion or Christianity, it belongs in here. It doesn't belong out there. Newbegin recognized that was a particular thing at play in his culture, and he went after it. He's trying to recover the gospel and make it public truth again. The second feature for Newbegin, he's like, not only do we need to recover the gospel from the way it gets syncretized to the cultural story, we need to encourage the church then to fully indwell the biblical story. Once we're able to recover the scriptural story, we need the local church to indwell it. Indwelling the story is a big thing for him. His thoughts influenced by the Hungarian physicist Michael Polanyi, who talked about when a doctor is going to work on someone, the doctor isn't thinking about the scalpel in his hand. The doctor is thinking about that thing that he is trying to remove through the scalpel. The doctor in that moment, the doctor is indwelling the scalpel. The scalpel becomes an extension of him. So he's able to go to work and to save a life. And he says, Christians, we ought to so indwell the scriptural story that we're not even looking at it, but we're looking through it to the world around us. So his writings, they teach us this, the importance of story. He is trying to recover the fact that the scriptural story is the true story of the whole world. So then a bit of a resurgence of that idea of late. A lot of people find that in Newbegin's move here. The congregation must indwell this story. And as the congregation indwells this story, the congregation is able to critique this story. But I think this is why we almost have to pattern this through carefully. If we just get in here and say, hey, we need to go out there and we need to go critique the cultural story. So here's like the top four ways to get into your neighborhood this afternoon. Read the culture and critique the culture. We first need to consider, are there ways that the gospel has actually been co-opted by this cultural story? Are there themes and patterns in the cultural story that the gospel is being told, no, you're just going to be relegated to the private world of values. You do not belong in the public world of facts. Newbegin had to work through that before he was able to encourage a congregation of people in this. These three implications of indwelling, we can just move through this. It gets over to a place where Newbegin was encouraging people. We don't just need to share the gospel with our culture, though we do. The culture in which the church lives, according to Newbegin, it ought to be confronted theologically. So let's think about this. This requires a specific understanding of what culture is. We don't have time to go through this at length, but the essential reading here is H. Richard Niebuhr's Christ and Culture, and just appreciating these five different ways that Christ is understood to relate to culture throughout time. It's really a spectrum. On one end of the culture, on one end of the spectrum, are people who just take Christ and they just make him a bit of an ideal within the culture. I think this is really what happens in like the American South. You might know this from your own particular place that you're from. But Christ isn't this distinct person or thing. He's just part of it, man. Like to be Christian is to be American, and to be American is to be Christian. It's some of that stuff, right? That's on one end of the spectrum. On the other end of the spectrum, he's not the highest ideal. It's this like two kingdoms view where Christ and culture are just in constant combat with one another. And somewhere on the middle of that spectrum is this idea that Christ is the transformer or the redeemer of culture. So he's a bit of an ideal. He's the deepest hope and aspiration and longing of everyone within the culture that they're looking to enthrone him for. But he's also at odds with that. But he's not completely at odds with that either. He actually fulfills their deepest longing. So if those were three bits there, we need to understand our own culture. And then we have to confront it theologically. So Newbegin, in his writings, he was big. Like what he actually does in that late body of work, like you read the Gospel in Pluralist Society, and you see a man trying to help a people challenge the entire framework of thought in the particular culture of which they're in. Now, Newbegin is relevant for us Because we can go back and we can read him and we can see there was a guy in a context working on the particular culture around him. The most helpful thing we can probably take from him is the method that he was doing, how he's reading a culture and confronting a culture. And that, my friends, is why we always need to be about this very work. Always recover, always making sure the gospel's recovered, always indwelling the biblical story, always looking for ways to challenge the cultural story from the gospel within the biblical story. To hear some of Newbegin's complaint, it goes like this. I think this is in the middle of page 4. We have allowed the Bible to be inserted into the history as a very minor strand in the whole human story, one element in the history of religions, which is itself only one element in the whole fabric of human history. We have not had the boldness for which, for example, our black-led churches in Birmingham have shown to recognize the story which the Bible tells us as the real story, the true story, the story which explains who we really are, where we come from, and where we are going. So Newbegin looked around his particular time and context, and he says, where's the church not living up to its full calling? He says, we're not indwelling this story enough. So you can see how Newbegin's working it out. The final bit in Newbegin's theology of missionary encounter, and again, this is going to build in a minute, was this need to live as a faithful witness. You see, the task for Newbegin wasn't entirely, you know, academic or intellectual. It's not so we can get around a church and we can, you know, preach solid sermons to one another and feel good in the Lord. That's certainly important. That's certainly going to fuel something, but it's intended to go somewhere. And Newbegin helps us to see the point of all of this is to get a people ready for faithful witness out in the world. So when you think about this, he's saying what we actually need, we need to train people to live at the crossroads of the scriptural story and the cultural story, where all of these different currents are going to come crashing through. That's the moment of witness. That's the moment of challenge. So this is what he's offering to us. And he says we need to be able to challenge, patterned off the biblical narrative. There's lots to be said there. And this means we need a positive and negative relation to the culture. Dan Strange has done a beautiful job of this in the last 5 years with his recent works. But it's that work. It's what we see Paul doing with the church in Corinth. He's coming alongside of them. He's connecting and he's finding ways to confront and even subvert. This is how the church must live in relation to its culture. It's what's needed for a missionary encounter. So the church doesn't exist just to bless everything in the culture. The church doesn't exist just to oppose everything in the culture. We find ways to connect, to confront, and present Christ with an intent to convert. Yeah? That's what Newbegin's doing. It's just four headings. It's a big outline. It's probably very difficult to follow. Here's the other name to know. You'll see him reflected in the content here at the bottom. Michael Goheen. Michael Goheen's Theology of Missionary Encounter. Michael Goheen's a top Newbegin scholar alive today. Paul Weston, who runs the Faith and Culture Center up there at Cambridge, he studied under him as well. He has a really good reader on Newbegin. But Goheen met with him multiple times. He actually read Newbegin's entire canon, not once, but twice, totally trying to indwell this guy's thought to get a feel for who he is. Goheen recognizes an interactive combination of four factors in Newbegin's missionary encounter: the gospel, the biblical story, the mission of the church, and a missionary encounter with culture. And I give you all that to kind of bring you into this moment right here. Tim Keller in New York City, Redeemer Presbyterian Church, he's trying to figure out how do we bring the gospel to bear on a place like New York City. Sometimes it's easier to think about our mission by thinking about somebody else's. And Keller read Newbegin deeply, and towards the end of his life, Keller produced a volume that I just find crucially important. It was one of the most helpful things I read when I went through this. It's this little pamphlet called How to Reach the West Again. It's a play on words with Newbegin's very title. And if you look at the bottom of page 5, we'll just tick through these real quick and hopefully have a moment where it just gets real practical. So Keller's like, looking back on my time in ministry, looking back on Newbegin, what would this take? He says, first, we need to develop a Christian high theory. I wish he would have buried this in the list, because I think a lot of people read that and we're like, I'm not even sure what we're talking about right here. But he's basically saying we need to develop tools to analyze our culture. Secondly, we must develop a truly post-Christendom evangelistic dynamic. I think this is so helpful, especially in London. Think about this. Keller says for 1,000 years, the Western Church's basic ministry model was premised on the social reality that people would show up prepared and ready and positive. And he says, we're in a new dynamic now. So we have to find ways of drawing people in when they consider the gospel to be irrelevant. So we need a truly post-Christendom evangelistic dynamic. So Keller says this means attention. How are we going to get people to pay attention when they find the gospel irrelevant? We're going to need attraction. How are we going to help non-Christians recognize they have a problem which needs salvation? So this will mean questioning people's answers even before we answer people's questions. Just have to think about that one. It's going to require demonstration, a definite need to address the traditional objections that are there, and it's going to require conviction. We have to explain the gospel in a way that is a compelling and attracts late modern people. Keller goes on to say, number three, we need a category defying social vision. He takes up the work of Michael Green, who has a fantastic, fantastic book, Evangelism in the Early Church, and he just kind of copies and pastes the main headlines of that right into here. Basically looks at the early church and says, man, how are they living so different? Like, how do you go from a few hundred people to a few hundred thousand people? Outlines that dynamic, puts it here. Number four, a counterkesis for a digital age. This is one of the things we're trying to work out at Redeemer, finding new ways of teaching to mimic Jesus's You Have Heard It Said. Keller's saying we need new forms of discipleship that don't simply tell Christians living in the secular West, this is who God is. We need to start taking the narratives that are all around us and deconstructing those for Christians and presenting Christ in place of that. And finally, grace to the point. We must never lose grasp of the difference between the gospel of grace and religious moralism. Keller's like, these are my six things that are needed right here. So I just want you to take a moment for pause, and don't worry, I'm mindful. Lunch is fastly approaching. We're 40 minutes out from the airport at this point. The landing gear hasn't come down, but we're starting to our descent. That's a lot of information. That's thinking about Newbegin. That's thinking about Newbegin's understanding. It's going to be these four things that I'm going to always be holding in tension with one another. You know, that's listening to Keller, listening to a sage towards the end of his race, looking back over his ministry in New York City, looking over Newbegin, and thinking, man, what would it take to do this again? And the wise old man gives us six words here. I want you just to take a moment right here. This is a bit of a silent reflection, some time to write or type maybe. In your own words, in your own language, as this is raw and fresh in the moment, what would be involved in a genuinely missionary encounter between the gospel and your specific neighborhood and culture? I'd like to say it like this. What is the Holy Spirit saying to you right now in the warmth of this moment? Take a moment to jot a few things down and we'll move to close. That's a journey we've been on for the last 40 minutes. You can see how this isn't a simple bit we're talking about. I mean, Keller comes closer than anyone in saying, how do we do this? And he's like, we kind of need six nodes of ministry developed out there in the Christian world. You can see we're going to have to find ways of holding the gospel, our understanding of culture, what is God up to and what ought the church to be up to. We're going to have to find ways of getting this into our thinking that'll over time shape and inform the way we preach, we counsel, we share the gospel with people. But I think this is, when I saw the syllabus that Andy drawn up, I was so encouraged to just see this as one of the first subjects that we're getting into, because this is really key and core stuff. Our decisions that we make in here, it really kind of sets a tone or a trajectory that the rest will ride on. And sometimes sitting and getting a fire hose of information like this can feel like a lot. I just encourage you, you have time now to sit and to think and prepare and really sit with the Lord. What's it going to take to bring the gospel to bear on this particular neighborhood as a missionary? I have just four ways I understand it right now. This is an evolving idea set for me. Number one, kind of what I jot down when I do this, is we have to identify as missionaries. I think it's a particular need of the day, right? We have to identify as missionaries. It's like, well, I'm a pastor, or I'm a bit of a discipleship person. I think we have to identify as missionaries. New Begin shares with us as one who knew what it was to live cross-culturally, and he really embraced that. There are biblical themes available for us. You think about how much of the Old Testament is actually written to people in exile. We could probably do with embracing an exilic discipleship mindset and paradigm. Very common language in the New Testament. You know, we are just pilgrims. We are passing through. We don't own this thing. We don't possess this. We're stewards. We're gatekeepers for a season. We have to identify as missionaries. And if we identify as missionaries, that'll help us see. Like, our objective here isn't to find a room for hire on Sunday and hope they'll come. I mean, no, like, that's an extremely important part of what's happening here. But if we identify as missionaries, that'll shape how the whole week gets invested. I think the second thing we have to do, identifying as missionaries, means then we're fitted to learn the culture. I think we have to find ways to read our neighborhoods instead of mindlessly inhabiting them. And if this can be a struggle for you and me, how much more of a struggle is it for our non-professional Christian congregation members? Just mindlessly go through London, mindlessly wake up in the morning, mindlessly board the tube, mindlessly listen to HR, mindlessly listen to the gossip at lunch. We have to find ways of not only ourselves learning to read the culture. I submit to you, we ought to think of our preaching, our discipleship, the ways when we sit with people and develop a staff team, we have to help them learn to read and analyze a culture as well. Newbegin, Keller, others, they're actually really helpful. They spend a lot of time doing it, and we can listen to them do it, and we can take that on ourselves. Number three, after we've done that, I think we have to learn to speak the gospel to the culture. I think a lot of times we're focused on, well, I gotta speak to this particular sin. I think Keller helps us see we don't only speak to the sin, we actually speak to those deep structural idols beneath the sin. But we can also maybe gain a hearing in our culture by talking about the culture in a Christian way, not just playing the political games or whatever they are in your neighborhood, the way they're presented, but learning to speak the gospel to the culture. And finally, I think part of what's involved for us today, we as ministers of the gospel, we need to take up our calling to equip the church members as missionaries.